Thank you very much, Ms. Burton. Further questions of Ms. Worsley, Westchester? Thank you very much, Ms. Worsley. Let's see. We still have short one member of the commission.
Thank you.
Do you have a request like this or not?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, there you go. Okay, all right, I'm sorry. If all three members would like to come forward from the commission, that'd be great. We've already defamed you one time, Brett.
I apologize.
No, no, he's just fine. We said the best two looking members arrived first.
No question about that.
Welcome, Judge White, Ms. Mayor. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair Butler. I'm Brett Wilcox. I'm Chairman of the Economic and Community Development Commission and also Vice Chairman of the Oregon Progress Board. With me, you know, are Judge White and Catherine Nader, are two of our other commissioner members. In my real life, I'm president of Northwest Aluminum Company in the Dalles. The three of us very much appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to discuss the importance of economic and community development in the commission's work. I've served on the commission for the past 4 years, and personally have seen some very great strides made by the department and its partners in streamlining and enhancing the delivery of economic and community development services in the state. As you're no doubt aware, the 1997 and 1999 legislatures and the interim committees have made very substantial modifications in approach and priorities and systems, as well as the performance measurements that the Economic and Community Development Department works with. We as a commission welcome all those changes and in fact help propose them through the new directions in our 1997 biennial report. I personally served as chair of the 1998 interim work group, which involved members of the legislature, cities, counties, private business, and other parties to bottom-up evaluate the department priorities and services and to recommend changes to make it more effective and efficient. The work group recommendations that were put into statute by the 1999 legislature asked us to focus on four major areas: rural and distressed communities, Oregon companies, flexible partnerships, and sustainability. Since then, the department has completely reorganized its structure to better meet the needs of our Oregon communities. Our processes have been simplified and streamlined, and we're working with partnerships more than ever. The 1999 legislature also directed the commission through a budget note to evaluate our performance measurements and reporting processes. Realizing how important this was in my own experience on the Progress Board, I agreed to serve as chair of the Interim Task Force on Performance, which comprised a broad spectrum of participants, including legislators, to help us determine how best to report the Department of Performance. The effort was supported by technical assistance from the Progress Board. It certainly wasn't an easy task, but the task force and commission were very pleased with what we were able to produce. We believe the Economic and Community Development Department has the best set of performance measurements in state government. There are a variety of programs and services providing financial and technical assistance to communities and businesses throughout Oregon. We're no longer just about job creation. More and more of the staff effort and department resources are directed to assisting rural and distressed communities where water systems and sewer systems are crumbling and in need of replacement, where a few jobs can make a huge difference in the local economy and the community's viability. Another major focus now assisting small and emerging businesses and those owned by women and minorities has also altered how we evaluate performance. Recruiting big companies in urban Oregon may result in greater job creation, but it won't have the impact in the areas in which the legislature has directed our work. We basically see our responsibility as bringing together the two Oregons and helping economic and focusing on the economic and community development in those areas that don't have the resources to do it themselves. We understand that the legislature is discussing whether the commission and department's focus should be rebalanced to be sure that Oregon's economy and our efforts take into consideration the new economy. We very much would welcome that. We see our job as carrying out whatever responsibilities you assign to us, that's a discussion that if you would like to change our priorities anyway, we're feel we can handle those responsibilities. Our mission is just to do as you tell us to do. And we believe we've been focusing on economic and community development because that's the direction we got from the legislature, and would be certainly happy if you to consider whatever direction you believe is appropriate for us. We realize the performance measurements we established are not perfect, and we are continuing to improve them. The department's information technology and data collection processes need improvement to enable us to get the data we need to have the best possible performance measurements. I can assure you that the department staff has been working very diligently to improve the technology and the processes that will allow more accurate and timely reporting and performance. In all, we are pleased with the direction of the department and with economic and community development efforts in the state. There certainly is room for improvement, but in the 4 years I've been on the commission, I see a very substantial improvement, much more responsive, engaged staff, and greater involvement by all our local and community partners throughout the state. I think when you see the way that all members of the coalition, cities, counties, ports have joined around the effort, we must be doing something right. I urge you to support the changes of the 1997 and 99 legislatures to evolve economic and community development in Oregon. Thank you for your time and effort and all you're doing to help us carry out our job. I think Catherine and Dale have some other things to add.
Chair Butler and Commissioner members, my name is Catherine Mader. I'm Vice President of Mader Engineering out of Corvallis, Oregon, in my real life. I'm an engineer in the forest products industry, and I was asked to come on board the commission at the very time that the legislature redrafted the direction of the commission. Part of the reason, in fact, a major part of the reason why I said yes to being on the commission was because of that refocus. I spend probably 99% of my time in regions, not only throughout Oregon, but the United States, that are rural, that are distressed, that need that kind of valuable assistance in economic development. When I came on board the commission, I have to tell you, I was a pretty tough critic of how the commission was going and the direction. And the staff will probably tell you on the side that I have not been easy with them during the years that we've been on the commission, redrafting performance levels, measurement levels, making sure that the data points make sense to me as an engineer. I have to tell you that I've been extremely pleased with the performance of staff and extremely pleased with the performance of the department. It's not that we don't have a distance to go, but I think we've accomplished some amazing good in the state of Oregon. And to not recognize, even in looking at the peripheral data, the impacts and the benefits that we have been able to reapportion to rural and stressed areas in this state, simply is not looking at the data at all. So, again, I have to state that when I came on board, I was a pretty tough critic of where this commission was going. But I have been with them. I acknowledge the tremendous work the staff and the commission have done, and they have accomplished good levels of performance, and I would encourage you to provide that support that Commissioner Wilcox has requested.
Thank you very much. Judge White, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. I guess we're talking about what real life is. I joined real life 2.5 years ago when I retired. I was 24 years county judge in Harney County, and I've been on the commission since 1993, and I've seen the state in good times and in bad times, and personally I prefer the good times, and unfortunately I think we may be heading into the bad times again. And one of the things I've noticed in the years that I've been involved with the legislature, we tend to stint on funds during the good times, and then we throw money at it in the bad times, and I think we have our priorities backwards. The time to build the infrastructure to do the economic development is when the times are good. It's not trying to catch up after the times become bad. I guess I'm probably the token Eastern Oregon, the token rural, the token Democrat on the commission, so I'm pretty token. And so I want to speak at those issues that I think are really important for rural Oregon. When I talk about rural Oregon, I think of Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, the coast. anything outside the Willamette Valley corridor, which seems to be doing pretty good whether we operate or not. But if we're going to get away from the two Oregons that Brett talked about a while ago, we need somehow to bring the rest of the Oregon up. And so what I want to focus on, because I believe that the real problems facing rural Oregon are infrastructure, physical infrastructure, and personnel infrastructure. And those are the two things that the Rural Investment Fund Regional Investment Fund and the Port Revolving Fund do, is provide those type of services to rural Oregon. And I know there has been a lot of conversation about performance, especially performance as to the number of jobs created related to the money that has been expended. But I want to emphasize to you that in rural Oregon, we will never be able to create those jobs if we don't get the infrastructure in place. And you're not going to get a fast return with jobs until you get that infrastructure in place. If we choose not to fund the infrastructure, we choose not to have economic development in those areas who don't have adequate sewers, adequate water, adequate streets, roads, industrial parks, all of those things that you have to have in place before you can have economic development. And I know many of you realize that, but I just want to emphasize, because my experience has shown that over the years, the Regional Investment Fund, the Rural Investment Fund, are always up for grabs by someone. But I want to emphasize as much as I can how important those are to rural areas if we're ever going to reach parity or even come close to it with the rest of Oregon. The other thing I want to mention is, I think has been a tremendous help to rural Oregon, has been the Regional Development Officers, Bill Scott. We just had him in Regis. Now we have him pretty much to all the counties or a couple, three counties. You know, most of us in the rural counties, we don't have the staff to do economic development. So we depend on these regional development officers to follow up on leads, to help us make presentations and to find the resources that the department has to offer. And the other, now we have regional coordinators who bring in another level of expertise when there's problems starting to develop or when there's opportunities that it takes more coordination. And I think those are very, very important to rural Oregon. And so I think if I could make any plea to you, would be that you would continue to fund the Regional Investment Fund, the Rural Investment Fund, and the Port Revolving Fund. I think those are the three key things for rural Oregon. Without them, I don't believe we have the tools to compete with the remainder of the state. And, you know, we didn't do that well during times of prosperity of competing with the rest of the state. You know, Harney County's unemployment just hit 18%, and most of eastern Oregon is going up now. As you all well know, the natural resource business is in the doldrums. We hardly cut any trees off our forest. Now, on top of everything else, we're facing a drought that's going to seriously impact our ability to farm. Even Bonneville is helping out by trying to buy people's water up so they won't use it on agriculture, which may be good for saving power, but sure heck on the rural community that's depending on those people to buy their goods. And so that would be, Chairman Butler, my pitch to you is the importance of the Regional Investment Funds and the Rural Investment Funds and the Port Revolving Funds to the rural parts of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge White. I want you to know that I have every respect for the commission and for the information you bring us. I personally have a great admiration and respect for you, Judge White, and having worked with you side by side in the Association of Oregon County. And Representative Ringel, this is the other Democrat in Eastern Oregon I was telling you.
Significant one. Mr. Chair, I whispered to Representative Smith here. I didn't know there were Democrats in Eastern County.
They're hard to find.
And Representative Smith said yes to the judge and his wife.
she's a little shaky.
Senator, he is recognized, please.
You say we can ask questions?
As much as this is the only opportunity we'll really have to have the commission before us, I think it's appropriate. So please, Senator, he is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Commissioner Mader, and I appreciate hearing you going around the rural area of the state and look at the rural communities. And you say you were impressed with the impact of the Economic Development Department efforts. So I would like to hear, what did you see that caused you to feel very impressed with the impact?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Reed. I think Judge White really hit it on the head. And again, I have to speak from my vantage point of my profession, which is an engineer. You cannot attract business to rural areas unless you've got infrastructure to be able to even incite a level of interest of activity. And the department has concentrated a lot of their energy and their expenditure funds in that arena, which I think has borne good results in terms of bringing that capacity building up to a level where the rural communities can start to compete.
Will you share with us which communities were impacted with the infrastructure construction?
We have actually a full listing available that shows the appropriation of funds, and maybe I could revert to Chairman Wilcox to cover those for us.
Oh, actually, don't have the piece of it.
You saw yourself personally.
There are 420 communities in Oregon. In any given year, the department will touch and have a positive impact on something like 250 of those communities, and it obviously changes year to year, but very consistent. We were hitting, affecting two-thirds of the communities with some project, be it water, sewer, community facilities or something like that. We have a policy of traveling around the state. We were in John Day, Umatilla, Medford. We try and get around as basically, other than when the legislature's in session, hold meetings, every other meeting, at various places around the state, and talk to the local community about what their needs are and see what they're doing. In John Day, for example, they had some very substantial needs to improve their airport facilities, improve their water system and community facilities, and so we had a chance to meet with essentially the entire community leadership about how we could work together to solve those needs. I was wrong. 240 communities, not 420.
I can give you some examples, Senator Yee, in Burns, Hines, in that area, when juvenile corrections were looking for a place to site one of their facilities. We had some people on the west side of Burns that were willing to donate some land, but it would cost $200,000 to put water and sewer in that, and using regional strategies and rural investment funds plus money for the city donated their time and effort, we were able to do that and were fortunately successful in attracting that, which was 55 jobs, which in Burns, 55 jobs is a lot. When we attracted SMC into the old Edward Hines Lumber Company, when they went out of business, we had to have some roads into that area, and we were fortunate to be able to use funds to do that. And then since SMC and LP went into where Edward Hines used to be, they were concerned. Edward Hines had its own water system, but it really wasn't adequate. And so for Hines to be able to take care of them, they had to annex that land and to service it. They had to have a water storage facility plus new water and sewer lines to do that. They didn't have to have all new, but several, but it was a substantial project, and funds from the department made those possible. And, you know, I don't know all the details in the rest of Oregon, but generally that's the type of thing that happens in rural Oregon that makes these things take place, Senator.
Thank you very much, Representative Rango. Thank you. Welcome this afternoon. I've seen a presentation chart that says that 60% of the jobs that are created or retained are in urban areas, not rural areas. And that troubles me a little bit, and I'm hoping to explore that over the next few days. But I'm wondering if you have any comments as to, does that statistic represent a problem? I mean, what are your comments on that?
We try and focus our resources on the rural and distressed area that don't have the resources. It's very relatively easier to help get jobs in urban areas. 10 years ago, the department was very successful at attracting large semiconductor plants to the metropolitan area, which has obviously a huge job impact. It is much harder to get a few jobs in a rural area and takes a lot more money. If you look at where our resources are going, we tend to make loans to help businesses in the metropolitan area that will get repaid, and so we get job credit without having a permanent outflow of cash. Tend to make grants in the rural areas to get a smaller number of jobs. All I can tell you is we continue to focus our effort on rural and distressed area, and some of those urban jobs are in distressed parts of Portland in particular. North Portland or the Lentz area is also an area of focus.
Does it represent a problem, or is it just that's the way it is?
Representative Ringo, I think that's the way it is, which is a problem. And one thing that's become obvious to me through some of the reports from economists and other that we've been privileged to have at the department is that I may be wrong on the percentage, but a high percentage, 85-90% of the jobs come from companies within Oregon. You know, we hear about the big ones that move in and create all these jobs, but taking those aside, most of the jobs are created internally. And what I've also began to learn is that you start with the nucleus. The nucleus is obviously the Portland metropolitan area. And then the way things seem to work is you fill out from there is that capacity. And the further you're away from that nucleus, the harder and longer it's going to take to get jobs. So I've become a great proponent of those close to Portland to fill up with their jobs so that we can get it clear out the birds. Well, you know, I'm looking very happily at Ben expanding so great that maybe some of that will take and come our way also. But we're looking at distance, and you know, most of our communities in Oregon were built on a natural resource base, and now that base has deserted us, so all of the cards I think are looking the other direction on most of the development.
Mr. Chair, well, we have no problem with making loans or grants to infrastructure needs, but we were looking at the list of the infrastructure needs, among which are for facilities. Some of them are destined to be closed, and the loans and grants is one on the list of was it an airport that was destined to be closed? And the loan is among the list. And I was looking at Albany City's infrastructure needs. And on the top of it, it is a privately owned hotel that's on the list of needs to be eligible for state loans and grants. That's rather unusual. Can you explain why would state loans and grants be given to privately owned hotels?
Senator Yee, I think we said in part, remember I made just a little bit of light of that yesterday when I said over in Clatsop County we had a dolly for Betsy on that on behalf of Representative Close. I think what this represents is this represents a needs assessment of what all of the counties and cities within those counties believe that they may need, that they could use, whether it comes from the OECD or not. So it may be that something of that nature, some private investment of that nature, would never come from the community development program, but but nonetheless, these it's my understanding mm-hmm. that this is kind of a Christmas list of if they had the ability to tap into $2.9 billion, that this is how they would. Well, I guess it's $2.2 billion. Because the rest of it is locally funded,
mm-hmm.
Certainly the commission. In other words, that's from the Oregon needs and
certain process.
And basically, doesn't that include just everything that the community thinks that they might need without any kind of? There's been no filtering process in this in any way, shape, or form, has there been?
Yeah, Chairman Butler, that is just a wants list of every community because both the feds and the state says if you don't have the project on there, if you apply for funding, you will not be able to receive it. So anything that they can think of that they might want to do, they put it on that list so that if it ever comes to pass, they will be eligible for appropriate funding. But, you know, a hotel, to my knowledge, is something that we were not be eligible for funding from our department. Isn't that correct?
Representative Ringo is recognized.
And the problem I have is in the front cover of this book, it says $2.9 billion in needs identified. It doesn't say wish list. It says needs. And to me, that gets blurred. What is just something that a locality submitted because, hey, it's free to submit an application as opposed to bona fide need? And I don't think that's clear.
The word of you change to wants.
Exactly.
Needs versus wants. But I don't think there's any filtering process. I don't believe that in that process.
No, but that's not clear in this. That's the problem. They specify that this is a wish list, that these are not identified needs. Because it says identified needs, and they're not.
I was concerned because Albany City Manager identified $279 million infrastructure needs, and when you look at the list, it's privately owned facilities. So I think that needs to be more focused.
Thank you, Senator Yee. Representative Johnson, you had a question before you left.
I apologize for stepping out for a moment. As long as we're having sort of a philosophical conversation about what the role of the commission is in guiding the agency, I'd like to get your commission perspective on what role you think is appropriate for the agency in doing huge projects with lots of tax incentives and lots of local partners. And let me bring this down so it's not quite so hypothetical. When you have the state's economic development agency coming in as the quarterback on a big project that involves, let's say, counties, cities, maybe a port district, philosophically, as the board of directors for the agency, what do you think the role of the agency ought to be in both the recruitment process and on the follow-up?
Well, Oregon's tried very hard to make it easier for businesses to locate and do business successfully in Oregon. So we have a one-stop shopping for permits in a lot of cases where the department's been delegated the lead responsibility. And so in that area, we may not be the large dollar provider, but we do help organize all the state departments that have to provide some sort of review or approval of the process. In terms of funding, we do try and leverage the limited dollars we have. So if we can bring in a federal agency or something like that, that would be something we'd strongly encourage.
I haven't asked my question with clarity. Let me be more specific. In the recruitment of United States Gypsum to Rainier, there were a lot of partners involved in that. The lead agency was OEBD, I can't remember where the C goes. It involved cities, counties, ports, an urban renewal district. Who philosophically is responsible for tying up all the loose ends on that? OEBD came to the table with a lion's share of the money. I'm asking from the board of directors' point of view, does that also accompany the lion's share of the responsibility to make sure that there's follow-up on the project and that all the partners perform the way that they're supposed to?
Part of the benefit from the port is jobs in Portland.
Right.
and part is jobs, the rest of the part of the state, or the grain that you mentioned. And I'm wondering if you can give me some sort of estimate as to which part benefits more. Is it in terms of jobs? If we increase the depth by 3 feet, are you going to have some job creation in Portland, but more in other parts of the state?
Chair, I'll try to answer the question, Representative Ringo. First of all, we have done a lot of review of what the job implication is, and there will be others specifically. Mr. Witt will give you some comments specifically about job numbers. I can give those also, but I know he was planning to cover that. I would let him do that, but I'd be happy to tell you that we've also done the studies. I think the important thing to consider when we look at this project, it's not so much a question of trying to develop new jobs. What we're really concerned about is retaining first and foremost what we've got. When Delta Airlines left Portland earlier this year, with that went some jobs, and with that went opportunity. And what we're talking about in this project, first and foremost, is retaining what we've got, keeping the access that Oregon shippers have today, and that's at stake. So if you say that 1 in 4 jobs or 1 in 5 jobs in the metropolitan area, whatever the number is you want to use, and I think it's probably in the Multnomah County, Tri-County area, Clark County, it's probably more in the 1 to 4, could be as much as a couple hundred thousand jobs in some way or another touched by what goes on in terms of sea trade. Why then, or trade in general, then what you're talking about is creating an environment that will keep those job opportunities in place. Going to the future, I think much of the growth depends upon strategies that we take and efforts we put forth, such as the gypsum plant and the ethanol plant in the St. Helens area. Those are examples of new opportunities that are waiting to basically materialize depending upon whether or not the transportation system is in place. So I hope I've given you some flavor. We're really talking about trying to keep what we've got first and foremost, and then build an environment that will allow for meeting Oregonians' needs in the future.
Representative Johnson, or Senator, you had a question.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for your presentation. My son and I went back a long ways when he was chairman of the Ways and Means, sitting where Chair Butler is sitting, and he always told me, keep your powder dry. And all the time I thought it was face powder. I didn't know it was gunpowder. But I have a question.
Senator, you are paid up. Please, let me off the hook.
So my question is pretty much the same as Representative Johnson's question. I want to know what's your 5-year plan. I mean, once you deepen the channel in 5 years, what's your plan to be competitive?
Chair, Senator Yee, if I understand the question you're asking, Senator Yee, you're asking me what is the Port of Portland's plan to continue to be a competitive port if assuming the channel project goes forward?
Yes.
So much of what we do at the port reflects what happens in the state of Oregon. As I commented in some of my numbers, who would have thought several years ago when we were talking about grass straw and what do you do with it, that the solution would come about eventually because you had an efficient transportation system that allowed that product to go to a market in Japan or a market in Korea and be used in the feed chain and do it in a way that was economically feasible. So what I'm suggesting is, in answering the question, the port is not going to drive the economic behavior of the state of Oregon. But I can assure you this, to the extent that we provide good access, that we collectively provide good access, the economic future of the state of Oregon will continue to be positive and bright. Now, we see some specifics that in an attempt to answer your question, that I think are pretty realistic to look at. I mentioned the bulks, both grain and fertilizer products and other bulk materials. We will continue to, because of our superior rail service in the Columbia River system, we will continue to be a very strong port area that will continue to attract those kinds of investments that depend upon having access to both rail and water, or good water, rail, and surface road transportation. We've got land capacity in the greater Columbia River reach to continue to provide new opportunity. So our business plan really is to make sure that we're providing the services that this state needs. And we try to monitor that on a close basis. We're going to do what we can to make sure we serve the niche market that exists in the agricultural areas through containers, particularly some of the high-value food processing, fruits and vegetables and those sort of things. And so our plan reflects what it is that the state sees as its opportunity, recognizing the one element we provide is good transportation connections. If we don't provide that, the rest of this doesn't work. As I'm sure you know, in a dynamic global marketplace, if you can't get to the marketplace, you can't compete, and you will not be successful.
Mike, from your previous remarks, you're saying you're not going to come back and ask us to deepen the channel again once you deepen the channel this time.
Based on the study, Mr. Chair, Senator, based on the study we've done and based on what we know today, and given the dynamics of the Columbia River Shipping Channel, it's our best estimate that we believe that this project, the 43 project, when combined with the tidal impact and the fact that 9 to 10 months out of a normal year, there's more water in the river than even at the 43-foot level because of runoff and other stream flow. In the normal part of the year, there's probably 45 feet of water or more today. What we have is obviously in the low water season and a year like this when we're faced with drought, when we really hit those limits. When you take all those factors into play and consider the tidal implication, there's a 2-foot tidal implication that comes as far up as Portland as a result of ocean tidal event. You combine all those factors and then look at the market, we believe that 43 feet will provide us the opportunity we need to serve the state's interests well into the future. And I do believe, and I've talked with the carriers to a great extent, that at some point this great race to make mega ships is going to come face to face with the fact that in this country we do not have the infrastructure in place to accommodate the kinds of vessels that are coming. And at some point, a $150 million investment in a mega-sized container ship comes face to face with the fact that this tied up at a dock for a week while all the containers are being taken off and waiting for trains to move out because of congestion, the economics of the mega ship doesn't wash. That's an opportunity that I think plays well for the Columbia River region, and why I think our size with this channel size should serve us well. And Mr. Walker Biaschi didn't say this because I told him to say it. He said it because he felt it. And I'm sure you know K-Line is one of the three major Japanese carriers. So, you know, life is always full of challenges. You look to the future and you make your best call and you say what will work. And we think this will work given the cost and the benefit and what we think the market to be.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, actually. You've mentioned a couple of times in your presentation two facilities that have gone into my district, or one contemplated, one in, the USG facility and the ethanol plant. I've been fairly close to those sites, and it seemed to me that those companies made the commitment to build despite channel deepening, because at the time that they were contemplating siting there, it was access to the water that was important to them, not necessarily the depth of the channel. Do you have any reaction to that?
Representative Johnson, I'm well aware of the fact that they've made decisions to move forward given the situation that exists today. I also believe that they are aware of the fact that there is a project which, particularly in the USG case, will make the cost of their moving their products substantially, the unit cost substantially less, because their vessels that bring in the product are draw deeper draft vessels. So this will help their economics. But you're right. The Channel project per se, to my knowledge, and I was not involved in negotiating any of those deals and didn't talk to them directly from that perspective. But the fact is there is a shipping channel. And because there is a shipping channel and they need vessel draft or vessel access capability, made it more feasible for them to locate there.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
As you know, because we've talked about this any number of times, my district encompasses that piece of the Columbia River that goes all the way from the mouth into Portland. Not completely into Portland, but more. One of the things that my constituents share with me is the absence of sort of alternative analysis. How thoroughly were any other options for development at Astoria discussed? And the other option that I'm much closer to was the question of Port Westward. Just for the benefit of anybody listening to this who doesn't know Port Westward, it's a 940-acre site that's right on the Columbia River. It's an old World War II munitions plant that has sat largely idle since World War II, with the exception of a PGE power generating facility there. It's served by rail, albeit somewhat shaky rail. It could profit from substantial improvement. But I know from my experience as a port commissioner on the Port of St. Helens that when the port began seriously exploring loop rail in that site and the possibility of handling grain operations, that there was some pushback from the Port of Portland. And I'm curious to have your opinion on how much exploration of alternatives to deepening the channel with other industrial sites that could serve as alternatives to a $200 million and growing channel deepening project fraught with controversy.
Well, let me just say that the cost of the project is not necessarily growing, and I don't know that it's fraught with controversy. It's going through a process to satisfy and answer questions that have been raised relative to making sure the project can go forward without doing damage to endangered fish species. And that's been a part of the review that's gone on from the beginning. So the alternatives analysis, a part of the feasibility study, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, was basically conducted with an alternatives analysis as a part of it. Astoria was looked at and dismissed rather quickly because, quite candidly, there's not the land space there to accommodate the alternatives. And when you're looking at the alternatives, this is not just a Port of Portland alternative. You've got to, you have to look at the Port of Vancouver, the Port of Kalama, the Port of Longview, and those facilities, because long term, what you're talking about, can you deny access to those ports and move all of that activity someplace else? So it's not just a Port of Portland issue. It has to do with the ports on the Columbia River, and that's why all the other ports are sponsoring the project. But Astoria was looked at as a part of the analysis, and when you look at the land base that's available, there simply isn't enough land to accommodate anything close to one container terminal in Astoria, short of a massive fill of the estuary, which creates in and of itself a whole series of other environmental questions, which on the surface, when it was looked at, according to people doing the feasibility study, it was not a viable alternative. Besides that, there was not the rail or the road access to accommodate any kind of inland distribution that would be necessary. The case you refer to in Port Westward, while it was looked at, I believe it was had some of the same dynamics that it had to respond to and deal with. There is, as you pointed out, a plant that's going to go there and use a substantial amount of available land space in this location, from what I understand. And I'm not an expert on that, but I recognize that it is taking a substantial portion of the available space. But there was an alternative analysis done as a part of the feasibility project, and the conclusion was that it made more sense to deepen the channel than it did to deal with some of the other questions that I've covered.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is that alternatives analysis available?
I'm sure it is. It's a part of the feasibility study that was done, which all the ports participated in.
Another question.
I think the governor has very wisely nominated for a position on the Port of Portland a person from outside of the metropolitan area who comes from a part of the river that isn't the Portland metro area. What's your position on that appointment?
You're asking my position? I've not mm-hmm. taken a position. I think that's clearly appointing members to boards and commission is the governor's job. And from my perspective, the governor should appoint and the mm-hmm. legislature should exercise their responsibility to determine if, in fact, those appointees meet the statutory responsibility. And so that's between the governor and you folks.
Then perhaps I asked the question incorrectly, and I would rephrase it. From your perspective as the executive director of the port, do you have an opinion about whether or not having folks from other parts of the river system sit at the Port of Portland table?
The present, Representative Johnson, the present statutory direction that the governor uses today says the governor has the latitude to appoint people from outside of the tri-county area. Two people from each county have to serve. That gives the governor three people who can serve outside of the area. I believe that's a good idea, and I believe it's the governor and the legislature should determine how that should be carried out. Thanks, Director. Thank you.
Chairman, if I may?
Please, please. Do you want to come up as well? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing today in support of channel deepening for the Columbia River port system, which we believe is a means of assuring the future viability of that system. Columbia River port system develops fully $12.5 billion worth of annual waterborne commerce and both directly and indirectly impacts fully one-third of Oregon's economy, of which 4,500 jobs are represented by Oregon AFL-CIO unions. Those are direct jobs, Mr. Chairman. And we believe that, in addition, if you consider the tertiary and secondary impacts, we have an additional 200% factor on top of that. I would also point out that there are a couple of larger unions within the state of Oregon, namely the Carpenters and the Teamsters, that represent an additional 2,000 workers who are also employed in direct port-related jobs. If you refer to my prepared statement, I break out the sectors that those jobs are in. It's significant to note that the direct employment, which I've just referred to, constitutes family wage jobs. These are jobs that pay in excess of, on average, $40,000 per year, plus a comprehensive benefits package, and I refer specifically to a pension plan and health and welfare plans. Now, the third of the economy, which I've referenced, is threatened, and that's why the Oregon AFL-CIO is before you here today, threatened by the fact that the Columbia River Channel cannot accommodate today's deep draft trans-Pacific vessels. At the equivalent of approximately $3 million of cargo per foot of vessel draft, we face the very real threat of losing trans-Pacific shipping to other West Coast ports, namely San Francisco, Seattle, Vancouver, British Columbia, etc. And this is not something that's speculative, Mr. Chairman. I would refer you to the Oregonian article that's attachment to my prepared statement. Now, deepening this channel can and will be done in an environmentally sound and sensitive manner. Indeed, this has been done every year for the past 20 years at a rate of 5 to 6 million cubic yards of dredge material each and every year in order to maintain the present depth of 40 feet. And this has been accomplished in keeping with the Clean Water Act, with the Endangered Species Act, and the National Environmental Policy Acts. In fact, 99% of the dredge material, according to the Army Corps of Engineers, is coarse gray sand, and our organization supports all environmental studies that we believe are going to reach that very conclusion, that this is coarse gray sand. Capital and commerce are very mobile in today's global marketplace. And, Mr. Chairman, time is of the essence. Time is money in this regard, and we would urge your committee's or subcommittee's approval of channel deepening so that we may get on with this project, so that the Columbia River port system retains its competitive position in the shipping markets here on the West Coast, that we retain Trans-Pacific shipping, and that we continue to retain that one-third of our economy which is generated by this waterborne commerce. And I would be happy to attempt to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Brad. Question? No question. Thank you, Brad.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to also make my contribution here. I do that on behalf of my wife, who is a cancer survivor.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll pass that along to Representative Bradley.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Zimmer, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm the Northwest Division Manager for Wilbur Ellis Company's Animal Feed Division. I've been with this company for 21 years now. I grew up on a dryland wheat farm in eastern Washington that is still owned and operated by my family. My immediate family lives right up the street from Representative Ringo in District 6. Wilbur Ellis Company has four...
We feel for the rest of your family. He's not here so we can pick on him.
Wilbur Ellis Company has four locations in the Portland area and many locations in eastern Oregon and the Willamette Valley. We have agronomy offices all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. My immediate division has three locations in the Portland area and one in Ogden, Utah. The Northwest Feed Division markets approximately 250,000 tons of various animal feed ingredients per year. Of this 250,000 tons, approximately 50,000 tons is exported. Of that 50,000 tons, approximately 30,000 tons is currently exported through the Port of Portland. Most of that comes from our feed ingredient blending plant in the middle of the Pearl District, of all places. Our hay division, which is a separate division from the Northwest Feed Division, exports straw hay from the Willamette Valley. They help develop the export market that Mr. Thorne was referring to in Asia, thus helping alleviate the field burning problem that once existed in the Willamette Valley as well as Washington County. The hay division and the feed division also ship alfalfa hay and pulses from the Inland Empire and Columbia Basin via barges down the Columbia River, destined to various export ports. Our agronomy division ships various products up the Columbia River via barge. Those products come into the Port of Portland via ship. The Northwest Division, the feed division, recently signed a long-term lease on some property between T4 and T5. Our intention was to build a new protein blending facility for exporting feed proteins. It took us 18 months to find a suitable location with the property amenities, those amenities being proper rail service as far as the UP, the BN, reciprocal switching, ability to install all the proper machinery, et cetera, at a very, very sizable investment. Our intention was to move the export shipments of the new facility near the port to save on drayage costs as well as increase our throughput. We also wanted to move our export commodities that pass through third-party transloaders in Tacoma and Seattle to our own facility in Portland. This would help naturally pay for the new facility, but more importantly to us, we would have much better quality control handling our commodities in-house. Recently, we are advised by Evergreen that they plan to leave Portland by June. They are our largest carrier from Portland. Evergreen says they will not equalize our freight rate difference and pay the freight difference from Portland to Tacoma. We are searching for a new carrier to handle our cargo at competitive rates. We are truly concerned that other carriers will not be able to provide ample space, especially if we construct our new facility. More importantly, we are concerned that rates will not be competitive with other West Coast ports. Freight difference between Portland and Tacoma could cost us $600,000 based on our first year output on this new facility, which is roughly 3,000 TEUs. We have talked to Evergreen, Maersk, Hyundai. The size of the ships that they are bringing into the West Coast Asia service, as well as the Columbia River Channel, create major concerns. Lack of inbound cargo is also a concern. The Northwest Feed Division for Wilbur Ellis Company was founded in Seattle. We opened our protein plant here in 1950. We do not want to move back to Seattle, but for $600,000 a year in our first year of operation in this new facility, we may not have a choice. I want to thank you again for this opportunity to speak with you, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Question from the committee?
Mr. Chair, no questions. I just have a comment. You must have been there 21 years ago then. It wasn't that long ago, but when I ordered feed from Wilbur Ellis for my hogs in Sherman County, and you guys are always wonderful to work with. I would only say at one time there was a truckload of meat meal that came in, and came in late because of mechanical difficulties, and I, it's the first time I learned what it's like to unload meat meal with a Mormon board. So at 2 a.m., that's not a very good job, but it's not a very good job at any time.
We had Senator Carno, it's a smaller world than you think. I worked for Ray Carno for 3 years.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
I think you guys are good.
Very good.
Mr. Chair,
I didn't know that.
Representative Johnson.
I wanted also noted for the record that our last witness also left a very generous donation for the Cancer Society. Thank you. And you gave acronym free testimony so that you get extra points. This isn't the committee, it's a shakedown every time.
We're doing well. We've got to have invited testimony more often.
I want to remind the committee that when we first started this, and you remember Senator Yee came in, she thought this was for a party.
She's offered to have the party at her house.
I don't know if she's offered or if she's getting forced into
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mark Camlin, and I'm service president of Local 40 of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union in Portland, Oregon. Local 40 members work in Coos Bay, Newport, Astoria, Kalama, Longview, and Vancouver, as well as Portland. And Representative Johnson stepped out. I would please announce that I'm a resident of Representative Johnson's district. I live in Warren, which is between St. Helens and Scappoose. On behalf of the ILWU, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present our view on this project. We strongly support the project, and we applaud our state's prior financial commitment, and we urge financial reauthorization.
Mark, you can repeat what you just said.
In your absence, Representative Johnson, I made note of the fact that I'm a resident of your district and pleased to be, and we're almost neighbors.
I'm well aware of that. Thank you, sir.